A further visit to Hagerstown revealed only that it would not be in his best interests to pursue the matter. 16 further warnings ensued. To Air Force intelligence personnel, a General White 17 and a Major C. Alton, warned Willingham to tell no one, even if commanded to do so by a superior. Within 2 weeks of the experience at Langtry, Willingham flew over the same area to see what had happened. Not a fragment of the device could be seen. As in other crash retrieval cases, the entire site had been wiped clean by, I presume, a technical intelligence team COM-18, also known as a T-Force, usually assigned the responsibility of collecting flying discs at that time. 19. In 1967, Colonel Willingham made the mistake of mentioning his experience to a reporter for a weekly newspaper in Pennsylvania. On retiring from the Air Force with many decorations in 1971-72, he was informed that he would not be receiving a pension. "Of course, they didn't tell me that it was because of what I said," he told Doris and Riarty, "but I figured it out. 26 years of service went down the drain." 20. Project Blue Book, from about 1959 to 1963. Colonel Willingham was assigned to Project Blue Book, the third of the U.S. Air Force's official investigations into unidentified flying objects, 1952-69. Of the 2,000 cases that my Blue Book team looked at, I would say that at least half of them were totally unexplained, he acknowledged, at variance, not surprisingly, with Blue Book's official figures. The cases Willingham investigated were mostly on the East Coast, but occasionally he was ordered further afield, such as to Chile and Venezuela. "We were contacted by people down in South America who had seen these objects flying around and were very scared. So I went down there in an F-100, Super Sabre, and we flew surveillance, looking for the UFOs in the places where they had been seen. Some of these were night missions, flying up and down the coast, hoping to run into something. If something was sighted at night, one of the planes would be sent out, and another would take off shortly afterward to provide cover for the first plane. We were armed, but we were instructed to fire only when we faced danger to our own plane. If they were doing something to screw up our airplane, we could fire." He did not see any unidentified objects during these surveillance missions, officially logged as test flights with the 192nd Interceptor Squadron. 21 of incidental interest, a USAF cover reference for UFOs is, "was unusual helicopter activity. Furthermore, I have learned that foreign cases were handled by Project FANG, not Blue Book." 22. Willingham later learned about two other crashes of alien craft, one in North Texas, somewhere near Dallas, in the mid-1960s, when three alien bodies had been recovered. "They shut that one up really tight," he recalled. "It was hushed up very quickly." He was keen to visit the location, but access was denied. A second crash, also said to have involved the recovery of bodies, occurred in Colorado earlier in the 1960s. Yet again, the military clamped down on the incident. 23. He did not dismiss the possibility that the craft he saw might have been damaged by U.S. military intervention, a strong likelihood, in my view, given that since the 1940s quite a number of alien vehicles have been brought down to Earth by the military. Investigator Kevin D. Randall, who has served with the U.S. Air Force and the Army National Guard, involving numerous tours on active duty as an intelligence officer, believes the entire Willingham story to be a fabrication. He cites, for example, the lack of any military documents proving his service in the Air Force Reserve. All he could find in St. Louis, Missouri, where records of former military personnel are housed, was a record of Willingham's service in the Army from December 1945 to January 1947. What few records Willingham has produced are dismissed as fabrications or irrelevant. One is a reserve order which, Randall reports, seemed to indicate that Willingham had served 20 years of combined active duty and reserve time and would be eligible for a pension when he reached age 60. That applies for those who have not done 20 years of active duty. And so on. 24. Noe and Reuben sent me copies of several of the few documents pertaining to Willingham's service record which have been located. Though I am no expert, the reserve order does appear to have some questionable anomalies. But it has to be said that pilots and other military personnel who encounter UFOs frequently discover that many of their service records are either missing, or, as in the previous case of Colonel Roy J. Edwards, altered significantly. Both Notaris and Reuben Riarty find Colonel Willingham highly credible. So do I. Originally, no explain to me, we got started on the Robert Burton Willingham, IBW, case based on the recommendation of Dr. Bruce McCabe, a retired U.S. Navy physicist, who had studied the case for years and considered IBW a credible witness with nothing to gain by lying. IBW showed us countless photographs and pieces of paperwork from his military days. Randall contends that IBW never served in the U.S. Air Force or Air Force Reserve. When IBW has come forward with documents that show he served in these units, Randall has called them fraudulent. Reuben and I have cooperated 100% with all Randall's many requests for information about the case over the past 2 years, but it became increasingly frustrating due to his unsupported dismissal of key documents and his closed-mindedness about the case. Someone specifically assigned the task of discrediting RBW could not possibly have done a better job of it. Randall has stated to us several times that RBW should be charged with violation of a U.S. law that prohibits persons from falsely claiming that they received certain military honors or medals. But Randall can no more prove that these claims are false than we can conclusively prove that they are true, since the military has conveniently lost most of RBW's service records. Willingham was ordered by military intelligence not to disclose, and he lives in fear about that to this very day. He has told us that they have already tampered with his life, his military retirement benefits, etc. He admits to being deliberately vague and even misleading when Todd Zeschel, ex-National Security Agency, and NICAP, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, first contacted him in the late 1970s. If you read his 1978 affidavit, he does not give a date for the UFO crash. The 1948 date is something Randall injects to discredit RBW, but RBW never gave the date. In his 1978 affidavit, he was being evasive in order to protect his own skin. We have spent hours face to face with RBW. He is a straight shooter, down to earth, matter-of-fact personality with an extremely conservative background. Like Randall, Reuben and I also wish we had more hardcore, indisputable documentary evidence regarding RBW's military service, but the fact is, we may never get it. 25. Large craft intercepted over the UK. It was the height of the Cold War. On the night of May 20, 1957, Milton John Torres, a 25-year-old lieutenant serving as a U.S. Air Force fighter pilot with the 514th Fighter Interceptor Squadron in the 406th Fighter Expeditionary Wing, was on standby at the Royal Air Force Base at Manston, Kent, when he received an urgent order to scramble and intercept an unknown object. He raced to one of the two F-86D Sabre jets on permanent 5-minute alert at the end of the runway and took off. The initial briefing indicated that the ground control was observing for a considerable time a blip that was orbiting East Anglia, Doris later wrote in his unofficial report to the UK Ministry of Defence in 1988, released in a batch of documents in 2008. All the controlling agencies revealed that this was an unidentified flying object with very unusual flight patterns, and motionless for long intervals. The instructions came to go gate to expedite the intercept. Gate was the term used to use maximum power, in the case of the F-86D, that meant full afterburner, and to proceed to an initial point at about 32,000 feet. By this time my radar was on and I was looking prematurely for the bogey, unknown object. The instructions came to report any visual observation, to which I replied, "I'm in the soup and it is impossible to see anything." The weather was probably high alto stratus, but between being over the North Sea and in the weather, no frame of reference was available, that is, no stars, no lights, no silhouettes, in short, nothing. GCI, ground controlled interception, continued the vectoring and the dialogue describing the strange antics of the UFO. The exact terms and maneuvers they gave me were all predicated to reach some theoretical point for a lead collision course type rocket release. I can remember reaching the level off and requesting to come out of afterburner only to be told to stay in afterburner. It wasn't much later that I noticed my indicated Mach number was about 0.92. About as fast as the F-86D could go straight and level. Then the order came to fire a full salvo of rockets at the UFO. I was only a lieutenant and was very much aware of the gravity of the situation. To be quite candid, I almost s-t my pants. At any rate, I had my hands full trying to fly, search for bogeys, and now selecting a hot load on the switches. I asked for authentication of the order to fire, and I received it. The authentication was valid, and I selected 24, 2.75-inch Mighty Mouse, rockets to salvo. I wasn't paying too much attention to my wingman, but I clearly remember him giving a roger to all the transmissions. Instructions were given to look 30 degrees to the port for my bogey. I did not have a hard time at all. There it was exactly where I was told it would be, on his radar. The blip was burning a hole in the radar with its incredible intensity. I had a lock-on that had the proportions of an aircraft carrier. By that, I mean the return on the radar was so strong that it could not be overlooked by the fire control system on the F-86D, and it was the best target I could ever remember locking onto. I had locked on in just a few seconds, and I locked on exactly 15 miles, which was the maximum range for lock-on. I called to the GCI Judy, which signified that I would take all further steering information from my radar computer. I had an overtake of 800 knots and my radar was stable, Doris's report continues. The dot, on the screen, was centered and only the slightest corrections were necessary. This was a very fast intercept and the circle started to shrink. I called 20 seconds and the GCI indicated he was standing by. The overtake was still indicating in the 7 or 8 o'clock position. At about 10 seconds to go, I noticed that the overtake position was changing its position. It moved rapidly to the 6 o'clock, then 3 o'clock, then 12 o'clock, and finally rested about the 11 o'clock position. This indicated a negative overtake of 200 knots, the maximum negative overtake displayed. There was no way of knowing what the actual speed of the UFO was, as he could be traveling at very high Mach numbers and I would only see the 200-knot negative overtake. The circle, which was down to about an inch and a half in diameter, started to open up rapidly. Within seconds it was back to 3 inches in diameter, and the blip was visible in the black and jizzle band moving up the scope. This meant that it was going away from me. I reported this to the GCI site and they replied by asking, "Do you have a tally-ho?" I replied that I was still in the soup and could see nothing. By this time the UFO had broken lock and I saw him leaving my 30-mile range. Again I reported that he was gone, only to be told that he was off their scope as well. 26, Doris had the impression the craft was moving at no less than Mach 10, over 7,000 miles per hour, when it disappeared. It didn't follow classic Newtonian mechanics, he told reporter Billy Cox. It made a right turn almost on a dime. The RAF radar scope had a range of 250 miles. And after two sweeps, which took 2 seconds, it was gone. 27 The pilots were then vectored back to Manston. A cloak of secrecy, back in the alert tent, I talked to Met Sector. The Doris report continues. They advised me that the blip had gone off the scope in 2 sweeps at the GCI site and that they had instructions to tell me that the mission was considered classified. They also advised that I would be contacted by some investigator. It was the next day before anyone showed up. I had not the foggiest idea what had actually occurred, nor would anyone explain anything to me. In the squadron operations area, one of the sergeants came to me and brought me into the hallway around the side of the pilot's briefing room. He approached a civilian, who appeared from nowhere. The civilian looked like a well-dressed IBM salesman, with a dark blue trench coat. I cannot remember his facial features, only to say he was in his 30s or early 40s, 28. In an interview with the Times of London in 2008, the 77-year-old Torres, by then a retired professor of civil engineering, told defense editor Michael Evans that the man flashed a National Security Agency, NSA, identity card at him and warned that if he ever revealed what had happened, he would never fly again. 29. He immediately jumped into asking me questions about the previous day's mission. I got the impression that he operated out of the States, but I don't know for sure. After my debriefing of the events, he advised me that this would be considered highly classified and that I could not discuss it with anybody, not even my commander, as in the case of Colonel Willingham. He threatened me with a national security breach if I breathed a word about it to anyone. 30. In the Air Force Times, Dr. Torres elaborated that the agent had threatened to revoke his flying privileges and end his Air Force career if he talked about the mission. 31. He disappeared without so much as a goodbye, and that was that as far as I was concerned. I was significantly impressed by the action of the cloak and dagger people, and I have not spoken of this to anyone until recent years. 32. Lieutenant Torres later became a range control officer at Cape Canaveral for the Gemini and Apollo space programs before flying 276 combat missions in the Vietnam War and earned 13 air medals, including the Distinguished Flying Cross. He attained the rank of major prior to retiring from the military in 1971 and later became a professor of engineering at Florida International University, retiring in 2004.33. In other interviews, Dr. Torres expressed relief that he had not actually been ordered to fire upon the craft because he was certain he would have been vaporized. 34 and asserted his conviction that the craft was designed by an alien intelligence. 35. My impression, he concludes in his report to the Ministry of Defense, was that whatever the aircraft, or spacecraft, was, it must have been traveling in two-digit Mach numbers to have done what I witnessed. Perhaps the cloak of secrecy can be lifted in this day of enlightenment and all of us can have all the facts. 36. Chapter 9, A New World. If you can take it, Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Gosso served on the staff of the National Security Council, NSC, and became an inter-agency coordinator for the NSC's Operations Coordinating Board, also known as the Special Group, 54 12th Committee, or 5412 Group. As such, I learned, it was the most clandestine, covert, and senior secret intelligence authorizing and controlling committee in the executive branch of the U.S. government during the Truman and Eisenhower administrations. From 1961 to 1963, Gosso acted as chief of the U.S. Army's Foreign Technology Division at the Pentagon. In 1997, his book, The Day After Roswell, caused a sensation with the revelation that he had been instructed by his boss, Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, chief of U.S. Army Research and Development, to steward alien artifacts from the Roswell incident in a reverse engineering project that led to today's integrated circuit chips, fiber optics, lasers, and super-tenacity fibers. 1. Gosso also briefed Robert F. Kennedy, during his term as U.S. Attorney General, regarding the Army's effort to seed extraterrestrial technologies into the private sector. 2. Although Gosso describes in detail his viewing of the recovered alien bodies at Fort Riley, Kansas, omitted from the book was his close observation of a grounded flying disc and, later, an encounter with an alien being, which occurred while he was in command of the Army's missile firing range at Red Canyon, White Sands, 15 miles west of Carrizozo, New Mexico, in 1957. Gosso's record of assignments, in my possession, shows that he served as battalion commander, based at Fort Bliss, Texas, from June 1957 through August 1958, described in a manuscript provided for me, 3, which Gosso had intended for inclusion in his book. The separate events began with the intrusion and subsequent downing of an unknown craft. I took my small military plane with pilot and headed for the area where my radars had last located the object, he reports. We flew over the site and I saw a bright, shiny saucer-shaped object on the ground. He assumed it was a missile booster. 4. Later that day, Gosso drove an army car to the area where the unknown object had come down. I asked Fort Bliss to send me an old World War II command car. It was built high off the ground, had large tires and four-wheel drive, which was ideal for cross-country over the desert. So I set off for the area, about 10 to 15 miles from the downrange launching sites and well within my area of jurisdiction. I decided to go alone. I took my belt with pistol and canteen, a map and a compass and a Geiger counter which we used to test stray voltage in the connection between the booster and missile. When I arrived at the spot I had marked on my map, there was nothing there but desert. I sat in my command car and surveyed the area with binoculars. Finally, I saw something shimmering like a heat wave. Suddenly it materialized. It looked like a metal object, shaped like a saucer. Seconds ticked away and abruptly, it disappeared. I approached closer. I stopped and waited. Then again after about 10 minutes it materialized in the same shimmering manner, then quickly it disappeared. I timed its appearance, 48 seconds. Again after about 12 minutes it appeared again. I picked up a desert rock and threw it at the solid metal appearing object. The rock bounced off but made no sound. It disappeared again. I placed a large rock in the spot and some sagebrush. When it reappeared, it crushed both stone and sagebrush. By the time interval I figured, I had a total of about 5 minutes to observe the object in its solid state. On this appearance I gathered my nerve and went and placed my hand on it. In the hot desert sun it was cool, the surface was smooth, and felt like a highly varnished tabletop. It had no rough edges, no seams, and no rivets or screws. When it disappeared, I went back to my command car and sat to observe the sea, no sea sequence. Each time it appeared to shake, but more like a shiver or tremble. Suddenly on the next appearance my army compass started to spin and my Geiger counter began to fluctuate. I thought, discretion is the better part of valor. I started the engine, put the command car in reverse, and gunned it. After about 300 or 400 yards, the engine stopped. The object slowly rose, turned on edge, and with a streak disappeared. The bright-colored streak as it disappeared remained embedded in my memory. I started the engine and made 4 or 5 widening circles around the site. I stopped and got down, and thought I saw footsteps on the ground. They looked like they were made with a soft moccasin. I placed my foot alongside. I wear an 8C. They were half the size. I put the Geiger counter leads on one. There was no reaction. I placed my compass. They were pointing east toward my missile firing sites, about 10 miles away. 2 days later, Kosso was told to report to 2 range riders, who demanded to know what he had seen at the site. A booster from one of my missiles, Kosso responded. There could be dire consequences for not telling us what you saw, threatened one of the men. I am the commander of this U.S. Army installation, and don't like threats in my command post, Kosso fired back. If I press this button, a dozen armed men will surround this office. Consider yourself in protective custody, you will leave when I say so. Now, give me your identification and the name of your commanding officer. Over the phone, he explained to the officer that he had White House size only clearance and all other necessary clearances and therefore knew how to keep a secret. Later, Kosso flew over the area again to take another look at the object. But the area had been swept clean. 6, green time. While I was in command of the U.S. Army's missile firing range at the Red Canyon Range, I had one very annoying problem, relates Kosso. The range was part of the White Sands complex. I could not fire a missile unless they gave me what was called green time. This coordination was necessary so there would be no radar interference. At times they held me up for hours, keeping hundreds of men on hold. One hot day, during one of these lulls, I was downrange in my command car, with 2 of my sergeants. My command post was a white shack on a high hill overlooking the range. First Sergeant Willis asked me if I wanted to visit the gold mine, only a few miles from the range area. A mile or so from the D battery firing site, we turned off the dusty desert road into what seemed like a moon rill. Dark rocks on both sides, then into a sloping area with a dark outcropping like a cliff. We stopped and walked about 100 feet to a simmering pool of water. In the cliff area was an opening, where we entered the mine shaft. My men said antelopes, burros, small wild donkeys, coyotes, jackrabbits, birds, and even large rattlesnakes came here to partake of the cool water. It was like an oasis in the desert. A week or so later, I was in my command shack during one of these white sands generated lulls. I decided to take a jeep and go visit the gold mine alone. When I arrived, some animals were around the pond. I drove up to the opening, went in, and sat down and cooled off in the natural air conditioning. The soft dripping water sound was almost hypnotic. I dozed off, but then, my instinct took over. My right hand slowly went to my holster. I drew my .45 and snapped off the safety. Every other cartridge had a tip of pellets, like a shotgun shell. I drew the gun and rolled on my side. Suddenly, a word registered in my head, "Don't." In mental telepathy I responded, "Friend or foe?" The reply came back, "Neither." I was impressed. In the shimmering half-light, bouncing off the moving water, I saw a figure that appeared transparent. It had on a helmet, silver in color, large slanted eyes, and a bright red spot on a band across the forehead. See sketch on the next page. The message continued as our eyes met in the semi-light. "Will you give me 10 minutes, radar free, after green time?" I thought back. 10 minutes could be an eternity. "What do you offer?" "A new world, if you can take it." A sketch by Amy O'Brien based on Colonel Cosso's description of the alien. I started the jeep, looked back, and saw a figure in the shimmering light of the mine opening. I saluted and took off. When I arrived at the range headquarters, Captain Williams reported, "Sir, D battery locked on, for 60 seconds, on an object 50 miles out, traveling 3,000 miles per hour apostrophe. Tell D battery to send me the tape. The downed radars must have cleared an opening to let in a reported UFO. Did it pick up my newfound friend? Or enemy?" 7. On the alien's helmet, Cosso thought he caught a glimpse of something that looked similar to the familiar Caduceus symbol, that of the tree and the coiled serpent. 8. As for the Caduceus sign of healing, he wrote, "We compiled quite a list of medical byproducts and other advances of our R&D, research and development." The mental conversation I dismissed at the time as figments of my imagination. In 1960 I discovered that without vocal cords they probably communicated by mental telepathy. In pondering the request for green time, Cosso theorized that radar had caused loss of the craft's control systems, resulting in its subsequent crash. "A new world, if you can take it." There was no other reply possible, reflected Cosso. The debris from the Roswell wreckage, research and development, new concepts, etc., were nothing else except the beginning of the challenge. Many men have taken up the challenge. New developments are coming so fast, after a slow start, 1947 to 1960, that we can hardly keep up with them. If the alternative is destruction, we are progressing well toward taking it. Like Hermann Abbe, Earth said, "We have been helped by those from outer space." Most of what I did during my research and development tour were just concepts, but many are working out. 9. Interstellar capability. On March 23, 1993, Ben Ridge, who had headed Lockheed Martin's Skunk Works, which among others had built the SR-71 Blackbird high-speed reconnaissance plane and the F-117A Nighthawk stealth attack bomber, gave a presentation to the Engineering Alumni Association at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA, of which Rich was an alumnus. Two researchers I know, Tom Keller and Jan Hartson, who also had graduated from UCLA, attended the illustrated lecture. Tom is an aerospace engineer who has worked, for example, as a computer systems analyst for NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and Jan is an engineer and senior project executive with IBM Global Services. We sat at the front of the audience, say about 150 to 200 folks, Tom's report begins. I took a look around. The 200 or so capacity auditorium was filled with what appeared to be aerospace industry professionals, the press, members of academia, and a few military types in uniform sitting at the back, Air Force blue sweaters. Knowing the history of Lockheed's activity in military intelligence, my guess was that there also were also a few spooks there too.